The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters.
The final analysis revealed the eye-wateringly serious toll of punitive laws. And it was very clear that punitive laws lead to more HIV infections, more deaths, and they lead to higher costs for health. So an example of a punitive law would be national legislation that criminalizes same-sex relationships. And what these laws do is they drive people underground, they increase stigma and discrimination, and the fear of arrest prevents them from seeking HIV prevention and treatment services. And a third of all countries criminalize same-sex relationships.
Hi, and welcome to The Hearing. I'm Janelle Wrigley, your host for this week's episode, which features my chat with Mandeep Dhaliwal. Mandeep is the director of the HIV and Health Group at the United Nations Development Programme, which is the culmination of her long career working at the intersection of health, law, and human rights. Mandeep has done everything from public interest litigation and casework on behalf of individuals with HIV and AIDS, ranging to global policy and programming work that seeks to address inequalities and improve governance for health. Mandeep had an important message to share about the need for grassroots involvement and community engagement in human rights work, maybe especially where the legal profession is getting involved in countries or in regions trying to change legal frameworks. We talked about her work relating to HIV and AIDS. We talked about her and the UNDP's work in trying to improve access to medicines in low and middle income countries. And we also talked a bit about some emerging issues relating to climate change and AI and how those topics are intersecting with health and human rights. She shared a wealth of knowledge and experience. It was a really great conversation, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did.
The Hearing.
Mandeep Dhaliwal, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast. Really looking forward to chatting with you.
Great to be here.
I wanted to start by asking you to just tell us a little bit about the UNDP, the United Nations Development Programme, and what its mission is.
Sure. So the United Nations Development Programme is the largest development agency of the United Nations. We work across the environmental, social, and economic spheres of development. Health is a central component of that. Health, we see health as both a driver and an indicator or an outcome of human development. It is an essential part of the Human Development Index, which UNDP publishes every year. We look at countries, how they're progressing along their development pathway, and health is one of the indicators that we measure. My role at UNDP is leading the global HIV and health practice. We support over 100 countries to work on the development dimensions of HIV and health, and that can be work specifically addressing the inequalities that drive disease or pandemics, inclusive and effective governance, as well as building resilient and sustainable systems for health.
So that's a big job, sounds like.
It's very interesting.
Yeah. And you've spent over 25 years, from what I saw, working at this intersection of health policy, human rights, and development. And I'm curious, you know, what drew you to this work initially?
I have to credit HIV and early days of the HIV response for drawing me into, I think, what is a very powerful area of work at the intersection of health, human rights, and law. And essentially, what I witnessed in the early days of the HIV response was how HIV disproportionately affected marginalized communities who were otherwise deprived of their human rights in some way or the other. And that had a direct bearing on their health, on whether they acquired HIV or not. So vulnerable and marginalized communities bore a greater brunt of the HIV response. On the flip side of that, we also saw that when these vulnerable communities and marginalized people were able to mobilize, were able to realize their rights or demand their rights, they were an incredible force for the HIV response, both in terms of getting better HIV outcomes, but getting access to services. And actually today, I think the world has to credit communities of gay men, transgender people, and their allies in the early days of the HIV response for the global HIV response that we have today. Because they were able to mobilize, they were demanded rights, they demanded access to the benefits of science, they demanded more research and access to services. That is fast forward 40 years later, and we have a global HIV/AIDS response that has saved millions of lives and prevented many millions of infections. On an individual level, which for me I think was as powerful as this early experience of HIV, when I was working in India, you know, I was working with the Lawyers Collective HIV/AIDS unit, which I helped to establish with Anand Grover, who's a leading lawyer in India. And we did pro bono litigation for people living with HIV at the time. And we had a case, and I'll call him MX because we used to use suppression of identity to protect people's privacy and respect their confidentiality, who was tested without his consent for HIV and fired from his job for a positive test result. He was loading trucks, basically. That was his job. And he was otherwise physically able to do his work. So we filed a case in the courts, and we were able to get him his job back because it was deemed that, you know, a state concern could not discriminate on the basis of a medical condition if you were otherwise fit to do your job. And not to mention that he was tested without any informed consent. The impact of that case, and I watched MX closely through the whole process, initially coming and talking to us about his case, telling us his story, realizing that actually he could get this decision overturned, he would be able to earn a living wage, take care of his family. When that decision came in from the court, just to see him standing up a little bit straighter, you know, having his dignity restored, everybody wants to be able to make a living and support their family. That to me was really such a powerful example and reason why health, human rights, and law are so important at an individual level. And so that I've carried that with me for a long time, and I still, you know, go back to that this is the power of human rights.
Right. So you've had this breadth of experience, and you're talking about this, you know, the casework that you did in India with the Lawyers Collective, that grassroots work. Nowadays, you know, you're leading global initiatives. You're working across multiple countries. It sounds like you carry that with you, you know, that casework, that individual impact that you've had. Does that inform the policy work that you do today?
I think it does. And it does in a couple of ways. I mean, one are these extraordinary stories, you know, of how people have been affected for better or for worse by laws and either the protection of their human rights or in realization of their human rights or the loss of human rights and human dignity. For me, what's really, really important is that any discussion on law policy has to have people at the center, has to have communities at the center. Without community engagement, it's not just participation or rights-based approaches, but without meaningful community engagement, I think you cannot have global policy work that is relevant and effective.
Mm-hmm.
So in the same ways that in the early days of the HIV response, it was the communities organizing, demanding their rights, that's what shaped policy for the better. Otherwise, the policy would have just gone on and been blind, in a sense, to, or laws would not have been sufficient to meet the needs of people. And so I think the engagement of communities is really, really critical. And even at the global policy level, this is something that I champion, that we need to really, really give voice to and create the platforms for people to be able to express their and share their experiences and their views on how they're being affected by laws and policies that shape their health.
I'm hoping we could talk a little bit later in more detail about sort of your suggestions or experience on how grassroots communities can get more involved. In the meantime, and I know we'll never have a chance to talk about everything, but I wanted to ask, you know, what are the issues that you're most concerned about right now in your work?
Probably about three buckets of issues. So one is HIV. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not over. I think it's kind of fallen off the political agenda in many places, you know, and we've been declaring success for many years in terms of, and it has been a very successful global health response in terms of the ability we've had to drive down new infections and to get millions of people on life-saving antiretroviral treatment. But the reality is we are still having 1.3 million new infections a year. So we're not turning off the tap, as it were. That number is still too high. You know, we've got 70% fewer deaths now than the peak of the epidemic in 2004. But the number of new infections is still way too high for us to end AIDS as a public health threat. I'm also really worried about climate change and environmental degradation and the impact that that's having on people's health. It has a direct impact on air pollution, which is a key driver of poor health and non-communicable diseases. And air pollution itself is responsible for 7 million deaths a year. So rising temperatures, water shortages, land degradation, food systems are struggling. So climate change is having some very, very worrying impacts on human health. Malaria is increasing in Africa. We've seen a surge of malaria in southern Africa. Zimbabwe, for example, particularly badly affected. By July, they had nearly four times as many cases and more than six times as many deaths due to malaria than the same period in 2024. So this is a runaway train in a sense. Then the final issue, that bucket of issues, is around AI and digital technologies. And I think, you know, the world is racing ahead in an embrace of digital and AI, and I think it is fantastic in terms of its potential, particularly in the area of medicine and health. But I worry about its impact on health, including mental health, if it is not sufficiently regulated, understood, and if we're not empowered enough to use it as a tool rather than have it just go unregulated.
Right. There's so much that we could explore there. We may have to have you back to talk about a couple of those buckets. But let's start with the HIV AIDS work that you do and that you have been very involved in for many years. You were the architect of the Global Commission on HIV and the Law. And we wanted to ask you to explain what the goals of that commission are.
Okay. So the commission, you know, the legislation, law, and even human rights were relatively unexplored and not well understood as in terms of what role they could play in the HIV response. So we brought together a multi-stakeholder sort of independent group of experts, all sort of leaders in their fields in one way or another, from 14 countries, to conduct the first systematic interrogation about the relationship between legal responses, human rights, and HIV. We had President Cardoso, former president of Brazil, Ben Skowanis, who's a freedom fighter, former ombudsman of Namibia, economic and social commissioner of the African Union Commission, whole range of people. And the goal was essentially to figure out, what role does the law play in HIV and health responses and outcomes? Now, the interesting thing about this was, well, A, we had people from all regions as commissioners, but the commissioners didn't just do a paper exercise or a desk review. They wanted to hear from people. So we had regional dialogues in five regions to hear from those who make the law, who enforce the law, and those who are affected by the law and who experience the brunt of the law. So we wanted to hear the different perspectives. We had public health people, we had lawyers, judges, police, prison officials, as well as people living with HIV, representatives from marginalized communities, civil society, doctors. So we had a range of people. We also took submissions, which was essentially testimony, from more than 700 people covering 140 countries across all five regions that UNDP works in. So the commissioners looked at academic research, but they also participated in the regional dialogues, heard firsthand about what was happening in terms of both punitive laws as well as protective laws and the role in HIV responses. And they heard from, you know, from the testimony. So they had the, you know, the submissions from 700 people. The final analysis revealed the eye-wateringly serious toll of punitive laws. And it was very clear, and this is, you know, seminal sort of research which has been cited time and time again, that punitive laws lead to more HIV infections, more deaths, they harm people, and they lead to higher costs for health. It also showed that laws based on science, evidence, and rights can drive down new infections and support access to services and support dignity. To date, the Commission's recommendations have not sat on a shelf. In fact, they have inspired at least 90 countries to advance legal reforms. There's still a lot more to do, and in some places it's been one step forward, two steps back. That's something that we've learned. But it's extraordinary progress, you know, that the Commission has driven through their work. And interestingly, the Commission still exists. UNDP serves as the secretariat, so we track and support countries on the legal reform that they're doing, but we're also kind of updating it. We issued a supplement in 2018 that looked at digital technologies, that looked, you know, more specifically at issues around criminalization, which continue to be a big challenge. So it's a very live enterprise. And I think the strength comes from learning from the firsthand experience of what's happening on the ground, and then countries learning from each other and communities learning from each other about what's possible.
Right.
And in a sense, it works well at UNDP because we have, as the development agency of the UN, we do a lot of work on governance. So supporting institutions, policies, and capacities around governance, working with parliamentarians and judges and lawyers, paralegals at the country level. So this fits very nicely into that mandate. And as a result, we've been able to, working with country partners, take forward the work of the commission in a very proactive and I think impactful way.
Yeah, that's great. I was curious as you were talking, you know, what are these punitive laws, or what do they look like? How do they undermine the ability to access HIV treatment or impact people on the ground?
Well, so the law prohibits or permits specific behaviors. And in so doing, it shapes politics, it shapes economics, society, and health. So it can be a human good that makes a material difference in people's lives, or it can cause harm. So an example of a punitive law would be national legislation that criminalizes same-sex relationships, or the criminalization of HIV transmission. And what these laws do is they drive people underground. They increase stigma and discrimination, and the fear of arrest prevents them from seeking HIV prevention and treatment services. As of 2025, July 2025, 65 countries and territories around the world still criminalize LGBTQ plus people, and a third of all countries criminalize same-sex relationships. Other examples include laws that make it illegal to access clean needles, as part of a science-based public health approach to drug use, something that we have known since the 1980s to greatly reduce HIV transmission among people who inject drugs. And on a positive note, you know, we have public health modeling data that shows that when you implement protective laws, when you have a science, evidence, rights-based legal and policy environment, you drive down that curve of HIV, new HIV infections, much faster. So you get greater gains in HIV prevention. And over time, you save money.
Yeah, of course. Are there specific countries or regions where you've really seen this work, you know, make a difference? You know, reforming these laws has made a difference in transforming outcomes.
I think we've seen incredible progress in Africa. Mm-hmm. We've seen incredible, but as I said, it's one step forward, two steps back sometimes.
Right.
We've seen, you know, we've seen incredible progress in Asia, particularly around laws criminalizing same-sex relationships, similarly in Africa. And HIV criminalization is another area where we've seen progress. In the United States, we still have a lot of issues with HIV criminalization. So there's a lot of work to do in the US itself.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
That surprises me. I would have thought we've moved past that in the US. So that's interesting to hear.
Yeah, I mean, from a public health perspective, you know, you have an infectious disease and it feels kind of logical that you pass a law or you use your existing criminal laws to prevent the transmission or prevent exposure or non-disclosure. It seems like a logical public health intervention, but its effect is completely the opposite. So, you know, in the early days, many countries passed laws that criminalized HIV transmission, and it was devastating, especially for in those days, we didn't have a lot of testing, so people didn't even know they were at risk. Today, about 134 countries can currently criminalize or prosecute people based on general criminal laws of HIV transmission, non-disclosure, or exposure. And obviously, this deters people from accessing services. In the U.S., it's at least 37 states that have laws that target people living with HIV through non-disclosure, exposure, or other HIV-related behaviors. And disproportionately affecting marginalized communities like people of color, women, people who use drugs, people who engage in adult consensual sex work. So laws that criminalize HIV lead to new infections.
Right. In terms of the work that you're doing, you know, at the commission level and then translating that into, you know, the process on the ground of actually, you know, working to reform laws in specific countries, what does that process look like?
Well, so we have a number of tools that we've developed because you can't simply go in and just audit a law. A legal environment in a country is quite complex. You know, you could have a constitution, you could have HIV-specific laws, general criminal law, there could be other laws. So the most important thing is to have a very clear legal environment assessment. And so we have a tool for that. In 2019, UNDP worked with Zimbabwe to conduct a legal environment assessment, which identified criminalization of HIV as a barrier to healthcare and a driver of stigma. So based on these results, the stakeholders that were engaged in the legal environment assessment and our approach to the legal environment assessment is, again, not to just do a paper exercise. Of course, the legal review of the laws on the books is really important, but we also engage the legal machinery in a country, including people living, and we also engage the, you know, people who are bearing the brunt of laws. So people living with HIV, we talk to physicians, so we talk to a range of stakeholders. And in this case, in Zimbabwe, it was the Zimbabwe National AIDS Council, the lawyers for human rights, parliamentarians, civil society, key populations, all worked together based on the legal environment assessment to advocate for decriminalization, because Zimbabwe was making very good progress on HIV, but it was stalled. And they decided that actually we need to get the legal and policy environment right if we want to continue to advance our response. And in early 2022, on the basis of that legal environment assessment, both in terms of what the report said, but also in terms of how we engaged with the country to do this, Zimbabwe repealed its legal code criminalizing HIV. So it's not just about reforming the punitive laws, but it is also about passing new laws to address human rights abuses. So, for example, anti-discrimination laws, which we're all familiar with in the context of employers not being able to discriminate on the basis of race, gender, religion, and so on. These have also been passed in some countries to protect people living with HIV. This has led to people living with HIV keeping their jobs and their homes and being able to live lives of dignity. Really, really critical. And I really want to call out here the Ryan White CARE Act. It was one of the early templates globally of anti-discrimination law for HIV. And it has really, really been groundbreaking in terms of the precedent that it set and the approach that many took learning from the Ryan White CARE Act.
Right. I can imagine that's helpful to have an example, you know, and then export that around. That's interesting to hear.
The hearing. You're an attorney with a passion to perform, a drive to be absolutely on your game. With superior resources, serious preparation, and total confidence, be your best with Thomson Reuters Practical Law.
As allegiances are tested,
you're gambling with World War III.
And regimes fall.
Fighters and civilians continue to stream in from other parts of Syria.
No matter where the story is, Reuters World News podcast is there. We make sense of the news shaping our world and give you everything you need to know in a 10-minute podcast every weekday. I'm your host, Kim Vanell. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
I wanted to talk to you about some of the work you've done around access to medicine. But before we do that, is there anything else around, you know, the work you're doing with HIV and AIDS that you want to highlight?
So a couple of things. One, and I think it's kind of been, been a thread through our conversation so far. So one is, you know, the involvement of communities, people living with HIV, marginalized communities, essential. From the grassroots level all the way up to the law and policy level. And I think there are ways to do it. It's really critical. It guides you in the right direction. Secondly, I think it's really important for institutions, government and multilateral, to create the safe spaces for frank dialogue and exchange on these issues, which can be political and sensitive, but creating the space for inclusive and constructive dialogue is really important, and we all have a role to play in that, particularly at the UN. Working with local, regional institutions is really, really important. One of the things we've done is work with regional networks of judges in Africa, Europe, and Central Asia, and the Caribbean. And one of the things that we do there, which is really, really important, is really, you know, share with judges the latest science, the latest public health developments. We share with them, you know, judgments from other countries. The results of this work with these judicial fora is really, really powerful. We've seen really progressive judgments in Antigua and Barbuda, for example, which struck down its laws criminalizing sex between consenting same-sex adults. In Kenya, in August this year, a court ruled that transgender rights had to be protected. In Eastern Europe and Central Asia, judges put out a statement a few years ago calling for their peers to use scientific evidence and human rights principles to prevent the overly broad criminalization of people living with HIV. So having the up-to-date information on science is really, and you know, and other rulings and other judgments, I think is very, very important. Similarly, and you know, the sharing across countries and regions is also incredibly powerful.
Great. And then, you know, moving on, as I mentioned, to although it's related to access to medicine, you've done a lot of work in this area as well. You led the UN Secretary General's high level panel on access to medicines. So I wanted to ask, in this area, what are the main legal policy barriers that are preventing people in, you know, low and middle income countries from getting access to the medicines that they need? And that might include HIV, but of course, all kinds of other things as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's good to put a number on it just for people to understand the scale of the problem. 2 billion people lack access to essential medicines today. That's extraordinary. It's extraordinary because if you think about the scientific developments in the last couple of years, and we'll touch upon some of them, science is moving at an extraordinary pace. We are not keeping up when it comes to access. And that is, you know, that is a shame, because one of the human rights is about everybody benefiting equally from science And we're not doing well on that. The, you know, the scorecard is not good, is not positive on that. One of the areas that is a challenge and is a barrier is intellectual property rights and patents. You know, of course, in addition to IP issues and patents, there are inefficiencies and weaknesses in national health systems. There isn't sufficient local manufacturing abilities. You know, countries need to be able to produce their own drugs and procure them regionally. We saw, for instance, with COVID vaccines, in many, many countries were waiting months to receive them. And still people haven't been vaccinated in the developing world, many of them. So we have to start treating essential medicines, vaccines, and other health products as a good public good that everybody deserves.
Right.
Right, and has a right to. If we all have a right to health, we have a right to access essential medicines, vaccines, and other health products that are necessary for maintaining our health.
So when we have, you know, these barriers that come from IP laws, from patents, you know, those are there to obviously incentivize innovation and research and development. It impacts access. How do you balance those two things?
Well, I think it's important to have a well-informed conversation on that. Now, we know that a lot of the money for basic research comes from taxpayers.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, the patents and the profits are held by companies. So, you know, this notion that we need to grant an exclusive monopoly to a company that has brought a product to market based on science that's public, largely publicly funded, we need to examine that a little more carefully. Now, patents block manufacturing of more affordable, accessible, generic versions of life-saving drugs. We know that, you know, when HIV, and I'll use HIV as an example, when HIV treatment first came to the fore, this was 1996, where we heard about the extraordinary benefit, life-saving benefit of combination antiretroviral treatment, it was thousands of dollars, over $10,000 per patient per year. No one ever imagined that we would be able to offer it for what we can now, which is just, you know, much, it's several dollars per patient per year now. And that is thanks to generic competition, because the head of Cipla, an Indian pharmaceutical company, said, I can make this for $100 or $300 per patient per year. So that, for me, is something that we need to really look at. You know, if we have a public health emergency, if we have essential medicines that are protected by patents, we need to be able to have access to affordable generics very quickly, because that has tremendous public health impact. Now, you can do that through voluntary licensing. That's super important. But the voluntary licensing also needs to be, you know, it needs to be given where you have substantial numbers of patients.
Right.
And not just to countries that, you know, so you can't cherry pick countries for voluntary licenses. They have to be for countries that can produce for the majority of patients. So, for example, in the context of HIV, there have often been debates about, you know, companies granting voluntary licenses, but excluding middle-income countries, which are essentially home to 70% of people living with HIV. So those are the kinds of things that one needs to really examine and have a look at. Trade agreements often extend IP protection for companies.
Right.
And this prevents generic competition, again, keeping the prices high.
Have you seen progress on this issue, or this could be another one step forward, two steps back, I suppose, depending on you know, which medicines you're talking about or which countries?
Well, I think we have seen some progress. So, you know, the big science breakthrough of the year is lenacapavir, which is a highly effective antiretroviral therapy for HIV prevention. It can be given through an injection once every 6 months. It's a real game changer. So imagine what it does for health systems and access if you only have to show up at a clinic a couple of times a year rather than every month.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, lenacapavir is costed at $28,000 per patient per year. It's impossible to roll that out outside, even in high-income countries that are struggling with health budgets right now. It's very difficult. But this year at the UN General Assembly, a number of organizations, UNITAID, the Clinton Health Access Initiative, University of Witwatersrand in South Africa, announced a deal with an Indian generic manufacturer who's going to make a generic version of the drug at $40 per person per year. So already you see the potential for access there. So, you know, we've learned some lessons. And this is largely enabled because Gilead, the company that brought lenacapavir to the market at $28,000 per person per year, has given voluntary licenses that allow 120 countries to be covered, which is amazing. So that's progress we've learned.
Right.
You know, but at the same time, it's important to realize, you know, we also have research that you can produce lenacapavir for, you know, $25 to $30 per patient per year. So just think about the markup.
Mm-hmm.
From the company that holds the patent. So I think, you know, Gilead has to be congratulated for giving the voluntary licenses and for, you know, which has kind of laid the foundation for, you know, this deal with the Indian generic company to produce it at $40 per patient per year. So that's phenomenal.
Right.
And that comes from the Doha Declaration of 2001.
Which said what?
Which basically created a global environment where innovation is matched by measures to ensure that innovations are accessible to all, particularly when there's a public health emergency.
Mm-hmm.
So it introduces a mechanism for patent waivers and a legal pathway to allow countries that can't manufacture for themselves to import patented drugs from other countries. It hasn't been utilized a lot, but it's an area where, you know, we need to continue to drive forward. But the voluntary licensing, as Gilead has now done, is also really, really important for driving forward the kind of generic production that can dramatically improve access and make it much more affordable.
Yeah, well, that's a good segue into my next question, because I wanted to broaden the lens a little bit. You know, you've talked about, you know, Gilead and you know, agreeing to offer the voluntary licenses and how important that is, and then the larger framework that was created in 2001 that encouraged that kind of activity. So I wanted to ask you, you know, more broadly, how useful, how effective are legal frameworks and setting up legal frameworks for the work that you do in trying to advance, you know, health and human rights?
I think the legal frameworks are a very effective tool. As the United Nations, I believe in a rules-based world order, and legal frameworks are an important part of that. Legal frameworks that are based on and grounded in human rights, and those human rights are universal. And I think those are incredibly, you know, the Doha Declaration, the, you know, laws that countries pass to decriminalize HIV criminalization, for example. So these legal frameworks are really, really important. And I think on the question that we started with, you know, you asked about balancing innovation and access. You know, I talked about the public investment, which is never counted. We only seem to count the private investment of companies. But I think we have to move to a world where we understand that pharmaceutical companies can profit at the same time as ensuring that everyone who needs them, medicines and vaccines, can receive them. They're not mutually exclusive. So we have to move away from this, you know, this simplistic model of, you know, you need a patent to incentivize innovation. You know, just to kind of put this in context, the gross profit margins for pharmaceutical companies are around 76.5%. By comparison, Apple's annual gross profit margin in 2024 was 46%. So I think we have to really do a better job of balancing access and innovation and really understanding innovation, the innovation ecosystem in its totality. We're doing some really exciting work with the government of Japan and the Global Health Innovative Technology Fund and an access and delivery partnership, which looks at introducing access considerations for health technologies for malaria, TB, and other neglected diseases in developing countries, but looking at the access considerations early. So we support, building national capacities for enabling legal and regulatory frameworks for the introduction of new health products. But we also look at, when you're investing in innovation and research, thinking about the access pathway from that point, rather than waiting until you have a product that's in phase, coming out of phase three to start thinking about access. So, there are lots of innovations which are possible if what is at the center of our focus is ensuring the right to health and access for all.
Yeah. And how do you bring all the stakeholders to the table? I mean, you need the pharmaceutical companies, to help on some level.
Of course. And this is the thing, like this Japanese initiative that I just talked about, was started with an early investment from the Gates Foundation, the Wellcome Trust, some of the biggest investors in innovation and science, the government of Japan and some of the private sector there. So you need to have, the civil society activism is really important, but you also need to have forums and platforms where you bring private sector investors, the public sector, and multilaterals together with civil society. And the multilateral system has a really important role to play in this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In the time we have left, I wanted to ask you some forward-looking questions and, some questions about kind of the environment that we're operating in right now. Human rights are critical. They're the backbone of what you're doing, of what the UNDP does. It feels like they are very much under attack in various ways globally right now. Where are you at in terms of working in the world today and working on human rights? I know it's a very broad question, but just taking the temperature of how you're feeling right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think, we're living in a world that is, polarized and fragmented. The sense of solidarity is really, is being eroded. And human rights are, they're universal. So obviously they are affected in this kind of world. I don't know if I call, there has been a concerted, pushback on human rights and gender equality. As maybe as part of this a broader trend around authoritarianism. But it also, human rights are also a framework for us to come together and to address a lot of these complex interrelated crises like climate change, new pandemics. And there have been some extraordinary developments as well. So in 2022, the UN General Assembly adopted a resolution recognizing the human right to a healthy environment. So that's amazing. Substantive elements include clean air, a safe and stable climate, access to safe water and sanitation, non-toxic environments, biodiversity, healthy biodiversity ecosystems. Procedural parts of it are access to information, right to participate in decision making. And in just this year, the International Court of Justice affirmed through a ruling that countries have a binding obligation under international law to stop, prevent, and protect from climate harm. So human rights and the human rights framework are alive and well.
Great.
And good to hear. I think we just, the world has changed. So we have to look at how we apply them, how we unleash their power in this changing world. And I think it's entirely possible. Climate litigation as a field continues to grow. So the London School of Economics showed that there have been nearly 3,000 cases about globally since 1986, and many of them are related to health.
Mm-hmm.
So we are seeing more and more, we're seeing more and more in this field and, powered by human rights. And there have been some really important advances, particularly in the area of climate change and health in relation to human rights.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
You mentioned a couple of, you know, positive developments just there. Is there anything else right now that's giving you hope in the work that you do?
Well, we're talking more and more about regulating and guardrails around AI. That gives me mm-hmm. hope. We did some work around rights-based and ethical use of digital technologies in HIV and health programs at UNDP. I think there's much more happening in this space on AI governance and regulation. So that gives me hope. Do I wish it moved faster? Yes. So yeah. What gives me hope is I see concrete changes on the ground, you know?
Yeah.
And that is really powerful. You know, in Lebanon, UNDP facilitated a dialogue between the ministries of justice and environment on the collection of unpaid penalties for quarrying regulation violations amounting to over $2 billion. And through our support, the Ministry of Environment has drafted a decision for collecting dues, and this has been enacted into law. So there are advances happening, and there's a lot of global, I want to call it noise. And what rises to the surface in the news and social media and all these information platforms is a lot of the bad news stories. But I think there are many, many stories of good news as well on the ground. We've seen public health and justice systems begin to recognize air pollution as a serious harm. There was a case in the UK a few years ago where there was a landmark ruling to expand clean air policies because of the work of the courts. New leadership, young people, no longer a north to south top-down world. Solutions, leadership, and innovation in the field of human rights, public health, and development emerging from the global south and being shared across countries. And I am hopeful that we can harness the power of artificial intelligence for health and development and for the better.
I wanted to close by asking a couple questions about how people can get involved. First is, you know, for communities that are, you know, most affected by some of the issues you've been talking about today, by inequities, by health crises, you know, how can communities get involved in legal reforms, you know, locally, if they're not lawyers or legal professionals themselves?
Well, community organizing is collective action, most important thing, raising the alarm, working with community organizations. And one of the things I've learned over the years working on HIV is think broadly about communities. Don't just think about people who look like you and sound like you, or who work in an area that you work in. One of the things that we learned in HIV is that it really was such a powerful multi-stakeholder alliance. Government, people living with HIV, civil society, the private sector, the UN. And I think thinking broadly about community, building allies, unusual allies, and really working and mobilizing with community organizations, use the courts. Mm-hmm. Learn about human rights. Super important. And most important thing is, you know, really bring that individual experience, the voice of the individual who is affected by, you know, the dirty river, polluted river, or affected by, you know, not having access to, you know, the latest HIV prevention technology. Bring those voices to the people who can file these cases in courts, who can do the legal and policy advocacy for change.
Right. And for those, a lot of our listeners are legal professionals or work in the legal industry. So for those who are lawyers or involved in law, what advice do you have for them to, you know, for people who may want to work in this area where health, you know, human rights and policy come together?
Everybody who is a lawyer should do pro bono work on human rights law mm-hmm. is the one thing which I think is really important these days. And whether that's in climate or whether that's in health or education, I think it's really important to get involved in that way because it is a specialized set of skills and it's really important. I would encourage young people who want to work at the intersection of health, law, and human rights. This work is more important than ever. And really, especially people who are from the most affected communities right now, to really, really be engaged, get together, and find ways to engage with legal professionals.
Great. Well, Mandeep, thank you so much for joining us today. This was really interesting. Your experience is invaluable for all of us to hear about. So thank you for your time.
No, thank you. I really appreciated the questions and the conversation. Bye-bye.
The Hearing.
Thanks again for listening today, and don't forget to reach out to us with any feedback you may have or topic ideas or anything else at thehearing@tr.com. Bye.
The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters. To find out more, go to tr.com/thehearing or subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.